From the independent producer project of KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is a program of stories and original documentaries. And today, three stories for the Father's Day holiday. They were recorded in front of a live audience, and they all happen to be about a dad's advice to a son. Beginning with this one from film and TV writer-director Mike White. He told this story at the Unfictional Night at a place called The Smell in downtown Los Angeles. From KCRW and KCRW.com, it's Unfictional.
Okay, so I had a nervous breakdown. It was like a few years ago. And I was running a show I created for Fox called Cracking Up, weirdly. And I it was like, you know, they hated what I was doing, and the whole thing was like super stressful, and it was like there was a lot of rage and like pain and like so I woke up in the middle of the night one night, and I was like, oh yeah, I'm so pissed, and I like wrote this email. It was like, you lied to me. This is to the head of the network. You lied to me. You don't know what you're doing. You know, like, you ruined the show. And then I CC'd like every bigwig I could think of, and then I sent it. And I guess I think I was hoping that they would fire me, but then like the next day I got a call, and they was like, the president of the network is in her office and she's crying. She's never felt so devastated by a writer. And I was like, well, that wasn't really what I was going for, but and then they were like, and where's the next script? And I started having like a panic attack. So I called my dad, because my dad is like the expert of therapist in Southern California, because he spent his whole life in therapy. Because basically the backstory is that he was raised by his evangelical missionary parents to be like the next Billy Graham. And he came close. He like wrote books for Billy Graham and Jerry Falwell. He was like in the evangelical elite. There is one. And he had his own ministry and a perfect wife and kids and da da da. But he was gay. So he spent most of his adult life trying to like get the gay out, like electroshock therapy and all these different kinds of therapies to just not be gay. And then when he realized that he couldn't do that anymore, he told his evangelical parents that he was gay, and they said they wished he drowned in the pool. So he spent the next couple years still to this day, going to therapists to, like, I don't know, get over the shame and pain and whatever, all that. So I was like, he would know a good person to talk to. So I called him, and he was like, I have the perfect person, Warren Jones in Pasadena. So I go to this guy in Pasadena, and the guy's like, do you ever have suicidal thoughts? I was like, well, I want to throw myself in front of buses, but that's not, like, new. It's like, And he was like, well, you can't go to work. You need to go somewhere where you can, you know, just relax. And that sounded good. And I was like, yeah, I don't want to go to work. In my mind, I was thinking it was like the Four Seasons with like a burger and sedatives and like, you know, Real Housewives. And next thing I know, I'm being checked into a mental institution where people are like, you know, like walking through the halls, like really medicated. And I was like, I'm stressed. I'm not like crazy. And they were like, you're here now, just get the help you need. And I was like, no. And so I ran out of the mental institution and got in my car and started driving as fast as I could. And then I looked at my phone and I realized there were like 12 messages. And I checked the phone, and it was all these executives and producers who'd like made my life a living hell. And they were like weeping on the phone, don't worry about the show, just get the help you need. Because this psychiatrist that my dad had recommended had called the office and said, Mike is going to a mental institution to get the help he needs. And I was driving on my way back to work. And then my dad called, and he was like, how did it go with Jones? I was like, it didn't go good, Dad. It didn't go good. So the show was canceled, and that was fine. And, you know, but it was one of those moments where I was sort of like, what's wrong with me that I could, you know, let a Fox sitcom get me that unraveled? And it's like, I need to do something different. I can't just, like, pour myself back into work, because that's what I'd been doing my whole life. And I was like, I gotta do something different. I'll go on The Amazing Race, right? Because, like, that's what you do, right? But in my mind, it seemed right. It was like, you know, you get out of LA, you do something, you don't take yourself so seriously. I don't know, Sartre said there's no adventures, but there are adventures. It's like 8 p.m. after 60 Minutes on CBS. You know, so I was like, in my mind, I was like, this is going to be the solution for me. So I made a tape, and I actually was accepted, and we were down to like the finals or whatever. I was going with another screenwriter, and we were going as like these neurotic screenwriters who never left the house. And in my case, it was kind of like just a, you know, that was my, like, the gimmick, but it turned out it was not the gimmick for him. You have to take a psych test and meet with a therapist, and he completely failed. And he was like, you know, they're like, you score off the charts with anxiety. And he's like, I know, I'm afraid of heights and planes, and I'm afraid my bowel movements won't be regular. And I'm afraid that I won't, you know, when we get eliminated, we don't get to go home. We have to go to this elimination station, which is not like a prison. It's like a resort in like Thailand or something. And I'm like, John, we're not going to get eliminated. We're going to win. And he looks at me in front of the therapist. He's like, do you realize how crazy you sound right now? Anyway, that didn't work. And I was starting to feel like, I was like, I can't get through these like therapist gatekeepers. Like, this is really frustrating. And so, but I was like, I really got to go to The Amazing Race. And so the casting people were nice enough that they came to a party of mine, and they scoped it out to see who would be the right person for me to go on The Amazing Race. And at the end, they were like, you got to go with your dad. And I was like, that's not really the vibe I was going for here. Like, I want to do something light. My dad's almost 70, but I was so desperate. I felt like this was my last chance. I was like, and my dad was gung-ho. So I was like, okay, we'll do it. And they pushed us through to the front. And, you know, like, we didn't have to do anything. All we had to do was take the psych test and meet with the therapist. And so we go down there, and I'm already looking at my dad, and he's looking at the bubbles, and he's like, really taking his time. I'm like, Dad, this is just a rubber stamp, so we can go, you know, we're not trying to get free therapy here, okay? Just, and he's like, And so we go in, and we sit with the therapist, and the therapist is like, I'm sorry to tell you, but you're Mel, that's my dad, you failed the test. And I was like, how is this possible? Like, if you've seen reality shows, like, they're all crazy. Like, how can I not know anybody who can pass one of these psych tests? I don't understand. And they were like, you know, I was like, what is wrong with him? And they were like, you know, he just scores off the charts as paranoid, like super paranoid. And what had happened is that my dad, after he came out, he decided to become a gay activist when he was trying to fight some of this religion-based sort of negative stuff about gays, because in a way he was trying to get his parents to love him, and he was trying to get the whole evangelical community to change their mind about, and they're not going to change their mind. And it's like, and so, but he would go to the front lines of all of these places, and people would spit on him, and, you know, death threat. I mean, it was like, yeah, I mean, so over the years, it had made him, yeah, he was paranoid. He was like, so he said, yeah, well, people are trying to kill me. I mean, I get death threats all the time. And the therapist was like, okay, well, then you have visions. He's like, well, once I was imprisoned for my activism, and I was stuck in a jail for 2 weeks, and I went on a hunger strike. And after 2 weeks, I saw my heroes in the cell with me, Mohandas Gandhi and Martin Luther King. I mean, I know they weren't there, but it was like they were there. You know what I mean? And I'm sitting there like, Dad, what are you doing? And he's like, well, what about Mike? What does the test say about Mike? And he's like, well, it says he's, you know, well-adjusted. I mean, and he's like, he's lying. He's just trying to make him look better for the test. He had a nervous breakdown. So she pushed us through. We got on. But then, the race was fun. We actually did pretty well. We got through like 7 legs of the race. And then what was so amazing was that then when it started airing, all these people not only recognized my dad, but they would like stop and they'd be like, you know, you are so sweet. You're so sweet. Your son, like, we love you. And it was, and like my dad, This was the catharsis he had waited his whole life for, for people to see him as this great dad and this funny guy. And it was weird. And after we got eliminated, a million people stopped watching the show. And I was like, Dad, those are Billy Graham numbers, you know? So I guess the point of the story is that next time you're going through some kind of psychological crisis or, midlife breakdown, maybe instead of therapy, you should go on a reality show. Because it helped us. So anyway, thank you.
You know Mike White from School of Rock, The Good Girl, Enlightened on HBO, and much, much more. I'm Bob Carlson, and on this episode, three stories recorded live, featuring some advice from Dad. Next is storyteller Ken Reed, whose father gave him the kind of advice best ignored. From KCRW.com, it's Unfictional.
My father, who is also named Ken Reed, he's given me nothing but bad advice my whole life. He gave me one piece of good advice my entire life, and this was it. When I was 18 years old, I sold my comic collection and I moved to a place just outside of Boston called Somerville, Massachusetts. And I moved to a very bad part of Somerville, Massachusetts called Somerville, Massachusetts. My dad came over to the apartment and he was sort of assessing the apartment, making sure we had everything we needed. And he asked me this question sincerely. He goes, "Where's your machete?" And until he asked me that, I hadn't realized that for some reason growing up, we always had a machete in our house in the suburbs for no reason. And I was like, "I don't have a machete." And he goes, "What are you gonna do?" And I was like, "Well, I don't understand. What do I need a machete for?" And he's like, "Everything." And I'm like, "Give me just one example." He goes, "Clear and brush." I'm like, "I live in a triple decker and there's no brush here. It would be nice." And then he goes, "What are you gonna do if you get a bunch of coconuts?" And I'm like, "I'm just gonna wonder how this happened. Were they on sale, or were they just here when I got home? Did someone will them to me?" And then, so then this is the piece of advice he gave me, the only good piece of advice in all my years. He goes, "All right, if someone breaks in here and they're gonna attack you, you go get that machete and they will run. And if they don't run, you should run." That was it. So my dad, he was very poor growing up. And like most poor kids, he really wanted a monkey. And there used to be a chain of department stores in the Boston area in the 60s called Zaire. It was a bit like Target, sold everything Target sells, except also sold spider monkeys. So you could buy a spider monkey for $60. And they sold outfits for $6 each. So my dad saves up for 4 years, mowing lawns, cleaning toilets, saves up $72 for a monkey and two outfits. Because you need an outfit when one's being washed. You can't have a naked monkey at any time. So he goes in there and he's 14, he plunks down the $72. He's like, "I want a monkey and two outfits. I don't care what the outfits are as long as one of them's a sailor suit." So the guy's like, "Kid, I'm really sorry, but 2 weeks ago they passed a law and we're not allowed to sell monkeys anymore." It's devastating if you're 14, but that's pretty good law. I don't think anyone... I don't know what side of the political spectrum you fall on, but there's no one in this room that wants to repeal the 1964 Anti-Monkey Sale Act of the Massachusetts... that's... But the worst part to my dad was he was like, "If I hadn't saved up for the outfits, I would own a monkey. If I could stand to have a naked monkey, I would own that monkey." And I'm pretty sure that is why he had me. That's my theory. He became obsessed with exotic pets. So my dad called me. I don't have a podcast, and my dad called me, which is unusual for a comedian. And my dad called me and was like, "Hey, you should do a podcast where people come on and they tell stories about exotic pets that they've owned." And I was like, "Dad, I'm not doing a podcast with you as my only guest every week. That's the only way that would work." We had a little bit of money in the 80s for a year or two, and my dad used it to buy exotic pets. That's what he did. We would go into a pet store, the owner would come out, which is a big deal. would turn the sign to closed, lock the door, take us into the back room and be like, you want to buy these? I don't even know what it is. My dad would say yes. He would ask everyone he saw if they've ever seen this for 2 weeks, and then it would die. That's what happened. It was that over and over again. So in 1988, my dad decides that he wants a snake, but convinces himself that I want a snake. And I didn't then, and I don't now. It is a green mussel with a thermometer for a brain. That's what it is. It serves no purpose at all. So my dad says this to me. Hey, if you're good this year, Santa might bring you a snake for Christmas. Which is such a mixed message, because I wanted to be good, but more than that, I did not want a snake. So now I'm considering like cutting girls' pigtails off at school, being like, I don't want to do this, buddy. I don't want a snake. I don't know why he's making me do this. So this was my entire Christmas list, 1988. I'm going to read you the whole list. Item number one, not a snake. That's it. That was my entire list. Not a snake was it. If my father had got me nothing, he would have gotten everything on my Christmas list from me that year. So I come downstairs Christmas morning, and there's a box under the tree for me. And I open it up, and it's a ball python, which is a snake. And I'm like, I don't know what you bought me for Christmas, but somehow, at some point during the night, a snake got in here and ate it. And my dad's like, we got you that snake you wanted. And I'm like, we have the same name, but you wanted that snake. You've confused us yet again. So my dad takes the snake out, he puts it on the carpet, and here's how snakes make decisions. I'm full of urine, I'd like to be empty. That's what a snake does. It pees all over the carpet. Quick thinking, my dad grabs the snake and rubs its nose in it. Right? To teach the snake a lesson, which is not a thing you can do. They don't do tricks, they are incapable of learning because they make decisions based on temperature. That's what I'm saying. But it did enrage the snake. The snake got angry. So he starts furiously cleaning the snake urine, and we see the snake start tracking his hand, right? So we all know what's gonna happen, which is why we say nothing, right? Snake latches onto his hand. It's a ball python. They're not poisonous, but they do have teeth. And my dad, just out of sheer shock, not intentionally at all, does the funniest physical move you can do when a snake is attached to your hand. He goes, ah! We dubbed it the reptilian helicopter, and it is legendary in our home. So then he says this, Christmas morning, he says, I need to cut its head off! Get the machete! I didn't know a lot about biology, but I'm like, that snake's gonna realize he's not food and drop off. So I took my time getting that machete. Like, I very carefully and slowly walked to our machete closet, and I just shined it up. And the point is, it's really not Christmas in our home anymore until somebody yells, I need to cut its head off, which is why we cook all our turkeys with necks on them. So thank you guys so much.
Ken Reed is a comic and storyteller you may have heard on shows like The Moth, Mortified, or The Risk Podcast. You're listening to Unfictional from KCRW.com. I'm Bob Carlson, and you can find all our past programs at KCRW.com/unfictional. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Unfictional. And today on the program, Advice from Dad, three stories recorded live. This last one comes from actor Steven Yeun. His dad once sent him a profound message with just one simple gesture. From KCRW.com, it's Unfictional.
It's a lot of people here. Okay. So, growing up, I wanted to be white really bad. Like, so I'm the son of two immigrants. I came over here when I was four. It was funny because my dad, the reason why he decided to come to the States was, he was an architect in Korea. He was making a great living, and he took a business trip to Minnesota. And he got off the plane and he was like, oh, Minnesota, this is the jam. I'm gonna uproot my family, sell my house, bring my two kids over to America. Minnesota is the But what's interesting is my dad always tends to, you know, he doesn't openly question it, but you gotta imagine at some point they're questioning their decision. I mean, my dad had a college degree and my mom had a college degree, and they came over here and they started businesses where my dad was stocking jeans in the beginning. What he started off with and then what he sacrificed to come here was so incredibly crazy. But for me, as a petulant kid, I didn't get that. So for me, I was like, yo, I grew up in Taylor, Michigan. So I was like, why? What? You guys from Taylor, Michigan? That's crazy. I grew up there. And I remember thinking, like, one of my best friends was this kid named Tony Hartman. And I was like, dude, I want your rat tail. I want that rat tail so hard. He had a rat tail, his younger brother Kevin had a rat tail, and his dad had a rat tail. And if you're imaginative, his mom, also by way of ponytail, had a rat tail. So for me, I was like, I want that rat tail. But all I could get were these bowl cuts that were so specific and caricature-ish. Did not help my game early on into being white. But I would want everything, you know. My parents, we were a little bit poor growing up, so we didn't get all the cool stuff. And I remember talking to my friend Tony, and I was like, hey, Tony, let's play your Sega Genesis today. And he goes inside the house, asks his mom, and then he comes back, and he goes, sorry, dude, we can't play the Genesis today. It's in storage. And I'm like, what the hell is storage? You mean your garage? Because we can go in there and get your Sega Genesis and then bring it to your living room. He's like, no, it's in another place. What do you mean? You're paying somebody to take stuff that you paid money for to hold it in a different place so it's not accessible to you? Like, that doesn't make any sense. But for me, I was like, I want storage. I want what you have. I want storage. Because for me, growing up in a Korean household, like we have things on top of other things on top of other things that should have been thrown away like half a year ago, and it's just piling up. Like immigrant Koreans are just basically hoarders, and it's disgusting. I also wanted to go on vacation. I remember my parents could never go on vacation because they were they opened up a store, a beauty supply in downtown Detroit, and for them they had to work 8 to 8 every single day on their feet in a not so savory part of town. There's some crazy stories about my dad getting held up at gunpoint, getting hit in the face with a shotgun, like crazy stuff. But he would do it because he was doing it for us. And I remember being like, why can't we have vacation? Why can't we go to Florida? Everybody's going to Florida. I wanna go to Florida. And we couldn't go to Florida because they couldn't put the store up to anybody else. Instead, I would watch my white collar Korean friends, my friend James Park, his dad was an engineer, and they would go with their dog, they'd go to Florida, and they'd have a blast, put all the pictures up in their mantle, and then for us, we just had pictures of us playing piano at the recital for the 50th time. You know, so it was like, for me, it was crazy because I didn't grasp what they were sacrificing for me to even be here. And one particular instance comes to mind. I was like 10, and I don't know what you can do at 10 to piss your parents off really bad. I don't know, like painted something on the wall. So I come home, and my dad's in there, and he's pissed. And he goes, Steven, go cut a switch. And I'm sitting there bawling, like, no, I don't want to cut a switch. Don't make me cut a switch. Because how demeaning is that? You're going to cut the tool that's gonna beat you in a couple seconds on your own, but you gotta do it. So I walk out into our backyard, and I just grab a branch, and I'm just crying. Like, one of those cries where you're done crying, but you're hyperventilating, so you're like and you're just cutting the switch. I break it off, I bring it inside, and my dad holds the switch, and he goes, turn around, and he pulls up my pants, because I'm supposed to get hit in the calves. That was around the time when hitting your child was getting slightly faux pas. if that's the term to use. It was just getting to the point where it's like, you probably shouldn't hit your kid. Like, that was the first time that I could say, like, I'm going to call child abuse. But for my dad, he didn't understand English, so he didn't know what the hell I was saying. And I remember we fought for 30 to 45 minutes. Like, me, like, turning around, and then all of a sudden, right before he takes the first swing, I go, wait, no, 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 like that. Or, like, just begging on the ground, every tactic, like, jumping on the couch, like, no, 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 like, crying, like, freaking out, like, please don't hit me, please don't hit me. And finally, my dad calms down, and he goes, in Korean, he goes, 네가 안 맞으려면 아빠가 맞아야 돼. And that means, if you're not going to get hit, then I'm going to get hit. And he pulls up his pant leg, and he just goes, bam, 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 while I'm freaking out, grabbing onto him, telling him to please stop. Like, I'm freaking out. He looks at me, and he goes, Stephen, look at this. That's how much I love you. That's a great psychological warfare to play with your kid. Really solid technique, you know what I mean? Like, it really worked. I didn't realize it completely to its full depth at that point, but in my adulthood, what I do realize is that I project all these things that I wanted my parents to be, wanted my parents to do, and how they want I wanted them to live, but they could only do how they knew. They're immigrants that moved in 1988, and Korea is not the same from once they left it, and America is something that they can't completely fathom. So they're stuck in this limbo, and they only know how to act and behave in that one 1988. That's it. You know, I understand that you can't take me on vacation because you're busy up on your feet all day working so that me and my brother can have an education to go forward. I can't expect you to have storage because we're going to have it in the house, readily accessible. My dad just turned 60 this year, and I was able to take him on a vacation. And it was awesome. I took him to Hawaii. I took him and my mom, our whole family went on vacation. And that was the first family vacation that we've taken in about 20 years. And I am very fortunate to be in the position that I am, where I can afford to give him that. What's crazy, though, is that the old Stephen would have said, let's do this vacation, like, all expenses paid. Let's do this the American straightforward way that everybody's supposed to do it. Let's bring our dog. Let's do all of this. But instead, my mom didn't bring the dog. She brought a rice cooker. And for me, the old Stephen would have been mad at that. But the understanding now, grown up Stephen, ate that rice like it was the best delicious rice in the world. Whenever my dad questions whether he made the right choice of immigrating to America, I can gladly say you made the right choice. Thanks.
Stephen Yeun can be seen as Glenn on The Walking Dead. All three stories on this episode were recorded at the Riot LA Alternative Comedy Festival. Thanks to Abby Launder. Recording by Will Bentley. I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional. The associate producer is Nick White. Thanks to the Enenberg Foundation, the Goldhirsch Foundation, and the Roth Family Foundation for their support. I hope you'll join me next time for Unfictional from KCRW.com.